The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
What is a fancy rat?
A fancy rat is just a rat that was bred for domestic purposes. Jack Black was Queen Victoria's rat catcher. And so he sold the rats to the fancy people, and they came in all different colors. You know, there are rats that look like Dalmatians. There are rats that look like Siamese cats. There are rats who are actually blue-colored, like Remy in Ratatouille. So it's rats that are only sold or used as pets.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a place for conversations with authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Rachel Tour about her book, Misunderstood, Why the Humble Rat May Be Your Best Pet Ever. Hold on. Even if you don't like rats, I invite you to stay tuned. You will learn new things, and you might even change your mind.
In Misunderstood, you respond to people who are disgusted by rats, and we'll hear about that shortly. But first, tell us why you think rats, and in particular, Iris, your lovely Iris, your late companion, are such wonderful rats.
Rats are like miniature dogs, and so they're very easy to keep, and they're clean, and they're smart. And most importantly, they're social. So they want to be with you like a dog. Iris would greet anybody who came into the house, like, you know, kind of like the Walmart greeter. She'd be like, hey, who are you? What are you doing here? You know, can I follow you around? And that's their attitude toward the world. They're very curious. They're very outgoing. They like to be held, unlike, say, guinea pigs that don't like to be held because they're ground dwellers. Rats are climbers, and so they don't mind being, you know, hoisted in the air by three-year-olds. They're very low maintenance. It's easy to keep them clean. They keep themselves clean, and they're just fun. So for the first, you know, 6 months I had my beloved dog, Helen, I kept looking at her and saying, there's no way I'm ever going to love you as much as I love my rat, Iris, because Iris was just there to love me. And Helen had her own ideas about things she wanted to do.
So why did you write this book?
This book started out when I was a graduate student at the University of Montana, and I was taking an environmental writing class with Phil Condon. And I was reading through the Norton Anthology of Nature Writing, and I came across an essay by Faith McNulty, who most people know. She was a writer for The New Yorker, and she wrote a book called The Burning Bed. And she wrote this lovely little essay about finding a field mouse in her house and naming her Mouse and loving her as a companion. And reading that essay made me think about a lot of things. And I was thinking a lot, especially about gender and nature writing. And so she was really writing about the connection that she felt with the animal. And at that point, I'd had a dog for 18 years who had died. I'd moved to Montana. I was living on my own for the first time. And I was lonely. And so many of my friends, our mutual friend, Judy Blunt, would say to me, why don't you get a dog? Or another friend would say, you know, Missoula's a really dog-friendly town. You could have a dog here. But I wasn't ready to have a dog at that point. I knew it was a big commitment. I traveled a lot, and I thought that having a rat would be easier. And so at that time, I decided to get a rat. I also read a fantastic book by a guy named Robert Sullivan called Rats, and the subtitle is A History of the City's Most Unwanted Inhabitant. And he spends a year in Eden's Alley in New York City, Wall Street, and just watches wild rats. And he gives you so much interesting information about the history of rats, about what they do. He talks to a lot of exterminators because rats are very hard to kill. He follows them around. And it's a great book of kind of urban nature writing. And I thought, I love this book, and I want to do the flip side. I want to do what he did for wild rats. I want to write the book about pet rats and talk about all the good things about rats, because, you know, he's very clear, like, this is not about pet rats. It's about the rats that people see in sewers and subways and are disgusted by them. And so I started working on it when I was a student here, And it took me a long time to finish. It took me more than 10 years to, I'd work on it for a while, and then I'd work on other projects. And then when Iris died, it became very hard to think about because I didn't want another rat. I loved Iris. And so I took some time away from it. And then eventually I was asked by an editor if I'd ever considered writing a novel about a girl who starts running. And I said, no, I don't do fiction. And he said, well, why don't you try it? And so what I realized in the course of working on that was I could take everything I learned in my first book about college admissions and make my main character's problem be that she was just rejected from college of her choice. And then I could also write everything I knew about running. And then I could also give my main character a love of rats that I shared and use all the stuff that I had research for this book and give it to my main character. And so I thought, okay, I'm done writing about rats. And I did what I wanted to do. And then after the book came out and I told that story, a number of people said, oh, I love rats, or, oh, I know people who love rats. You should write that book. And again, I'd never thought about writing for a young adult readership until I did the novel. And so I bounced it off my editor at Ferris, Strauss & Giroux, and he said, go for it. I sent him the proposal that I had written originally, to do it as an adult trade book. And he said, ugh, too long, too boring, too academic. Can you make it fun? And so I reworked it into something that was more fun. And he also wanted it to be more personal. And so I included more stuff about my own experience with Iris. And because anybody who's ever lived with a rat knows the only really hard part of having a rat, the only thing that makes them not an ideal pet is that they live 1,000 days. So you have to be able to deal with, loving somebody intensely and then having them die in less than 3 years. So the book ended up being about dealing with that kind of loss. The inevitable consequences of loving somebody is that you have to deal with the idea of losing them.
Hmm. Okay, here's your big chance to enlighten people who don't like rats. Let's hear a passage in which you dispel all their ratty misconceptions.
Yeah, and I will say that if there's a thesis for this book, it's that bigotry and prejudice rely on ignorance to thrive. So, having a rat made me think about lots of things, not the least being why, when rats are clearly superior companions, so many people are disgusted by them. Try to imagine describing a friend and having people respond, ew, redheads are so gross, or people who talk with a southern accent creep me out, or I hate tall people. I do actually hate tall people. Well, not hate them, but a jealousy this strong can feel like hatred. In truth, some of my best friends are tall. Most of us have learned that it's not okay to smush a diverse group of people into an easily reduced and quickly dismissed lump. Most of us know that even in a field of daisies that look identical, small differences make each one unique if we bother to look closely enough. When I hear smart, educated, socially aware folks say something as dumb as, I hate rats, I unfriend them. No, I don't, though I'd like to. Instead, I remember how bigotry and prejudice rely on ignorance to thrive, and then I try to teach them. If you don't like rats, I say in the gentlest, most teacherly tone I can muster, perhaps because you haven't gotten to know one. Have you ever met a rat? Then I steel myself like a football player on the line waiting for the hike. I know it's coming. I brace myself. I wait. It usually doesn't take more than a few seconds. And there it is. The tail, they wail. I just can't take the tail. Even the most articulate of my friends can't find the words to describe what they don't like about a rat's tail. So let's talk about the tail. It's long. Yep. It's long. That's because rats use their tails for balance. They can climb ropes, maintain equipoise in precarious positions, stand on their back feet, and use their tails like the poles circus performers carry on the high wire. It's naked, or at least that's what some people think who have never examined one up close. Why would a naked tail be so upsetting? Perhaps when we see animals missing patches of hair, we believe they're sick. Maybe that's it. People think a hairless tail is less healthy than the bushy appendage found on, say, dog-taunting, birdseed-stealing, car-crash-causing squirrels. Or maybe the naked tail reminds them of a snake. It's reasonable to be afraid of snakes, especially if you don't know which are the dangerous ones whose bites could kill you. But far from being naked and snaky, rats' tails are actually covered with tiny hairs, and they do another important job. Rats can't pant like dogs, and they don't sweat like horses. They use their tails for thermoregulation. When they get too hot, the blood vessels in their tails swell in a process called vasodilation, and the hot blood loses heat through the surface. And when it returns to the furry little body, it's cooled off. When a rat is cold, the vessels in the tail constrict and keep the blood, and therefore the rat, warmer. Pretty nifty trick, huh? Once I parry the thrust against the tail, I expect the haters to continue with another line of attack, and I know what's coming. They're dirty, filthy, they spread disease. And then, gaining momentum, finding their footing by searching what they remember from high school history, they get to where I know they're headed. Plague! They caused plague! I take a deep breath. I force the corners of my mouth to tilt up. I don't want to be that girl who blames someone for not knowing any better, for being, well, unenlightened. Making myself small and unthreatening, hunching and moderating my voice from the shrill tone that wants to escape, I say, well, not exactly. Rats are not dirty. If you see a dirty rat, he's probably sick. They live in grungy places because humans are sloppy and wasteful and throw away all sorts of great and useful stuff. Rats profit from our profligate ways. They settle in populous areas like cities where lots of people leave lots of garbage. And in places where there are fewer humans and less garbage, like the vast landscape of the American West, you don't find many rats. Rats themselves are more fastidious about keeping clean than a heart surgeon afraid of being sued for malpractice. They spread disease. Rats do spread disease, it's true. Hantavirus, meningitis, leptospirosis, rat bite fever, sole virus, murine typhus, trichinosis, sure. But dogs, cats, cows, pigs, bunnies, birds, squirrels, and lots of other animals also carry these diseases and more. Nature is filled with icky things. We've come to think that what's natural is good, but nature can kill you. If you need to be reminded of this, go for a walk outside during a big storm, rain, snow, thunder, or stay inside during an earthquake, or even just go for a swim in the ocean. There's some crazy scary stuff in the ocean, and you'll never catch me anywhere near it. As for plague, also scary. During the Middle Ages, when the Black Death took hold, it wiped out about a third of the population of Europe. But rats did not cause plague. They, like humans, fell victims to it. Fleas carried the disease in the form of the bacterial microbe Yersinia pestis, and they infected the rats they lived on, who itched, scratched, and then died. It's not the meek who shall inherit the earth, it's insects. Fleas found their way from the bodies of the rats they killed to humans, who died and were too ignorant to blame the correct critter. Fleas spread plague, people. Not rats. If you want to know more about this, you can find a plague of books written on plague. The malady existed well before the Black Death. People affected with plague-like symptoms appear in the Bible, in Periclean Athens, in the ancient Fertile Crescent, in early 14th century China. And it still exists on a large number of plague-infected but adorable prairie dogs in the western United States, where there are very few rats. New evidence links the spread of plague to... Are you ready? Gerbils. I can't tell you how this delights me. I have a suspicion that the pocket pets, gerbils, hamsters, guinea pigs, ferrets, hedgehogs, got together and hired a public relations firm to convince people that they make better companions than rats. Hamsters are vicious, guinea pigs are spastic, gerbils are anxious, ferrets are stinky, and hedgehogs can turn themselves into medieval torture weapons. Gerbils spread plague. Hooray! I can't wait to see those jittery little creeps go down. Not that there's anything wrong with gerbils. They just can't hold a candle to the brightness of my favorite rodents. They destroy things. The most knowledgeable of the rat haters may mention destruction caused by rats. It's undeniable. Wild rats cost humans zillions of dollars. They eat tons of grain, chew through wires, and cause outages and fires. They even gnaw on concrete. Wild rats do this because they are trying to survive. Just like the other pests, insects, wolves, hawks, deer. But how often does someone claim to hate Bambi?
You've been listening to Rachel Tour read from her book, Misunderstood, Why the Humble Rat May Be Your Best Pet Ever. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. You can listen again or share this conversation with a friend from our blog, which you'll find online at mtpr.org/twq. Links to our Facebook and Twitter pages are also there. Our podcast recently migrated to another location in cyberspace, so if your podcast feed goes missing, please reconnect with us at mtpr.org. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about pointy versus round animals and what to look for after you decide a rat will be your new best friend. Don't go away.
Back to what you said, that rats congregate in cities. In the first chapter, in a passage about why there are fewer rats in what you call the big rectangle states on the left side of the map, you wrote, "In Billings, Montana, it is illegal to keep rats. It is also illegal for married women to go fishing alone on Sunday and for unmarried women to fish alone at all." Really?
Blue laws. Yeah, there's still a lot of blue laws on the books.
So seriously, in Billings, you'd be breaking the law if you owned a rat.
Yeah, and the entire province of Alberta prides itself on being rat-free. So you can't own a rat in Alberta, and you can't even abate and abet somebody who owns a rat. So you get a giant fine and sent to the pokey for owning a rat. Usually the Canadians are so tolerant, but this is one incidence of prejudice that really surprises me.
I remember the color of the sky and the temperature and everything that was happening on the day that I saw Ratatouille when I came out of the theater. It's just emblazoned in my mind. I thought it was such a cool movie.
You know, one of the things that I really tried to do was look for positive representations of rats. Because in children's books, you find a lot of mice, you know, because mice are small and they need protection. And so we like them. But there are very few really good positive representations of rats. Ratatouille is such a good movie on so many levels, you know, and, you know, not least because of its message, which I think is, hey, you know what? Anyone can do it, but not everyone is going to be excellent at what they do, and excellence can come from anywhere. So I love the message of the movie, but I also love that they clearly spent a lot of time with rats. One of the people I write about in the book, Debbie Ducommun, calls herself the Rat Lady, and she's, you know, written a bunch of books, you know, rat advice books, and they went to her for advice. So she went to them, brought some of her rats, talked to the animators, showed them how the rats moved, and they liked the rat so much they ended up keeping one in the studio while they were working on it. And so I think if you watch that movie, you'll see how they get so many of the rats' movements right. So rats have lots of different gaits. You know, so sometimes, you know, when they're fearful, but they're also wanting to explore, they'll keep their back feet planted and then just stretch out their front legs really, really, really far so that they can still retreat. They can walk, they can trot, they can bound, they can leap. They're extremely athletic. And so I think the movie shows all of that in a way that feels absolutely true to how real-life rats make their way through the world.
So let's talk about the pointy versus rounded. You found out that Mickey Mouse began as more of a pointy mouse and ended up rounded. Can you say why?
Yeah, you know, this was part of the thing that was so fascinating to me. You know, when I started thinking about, like, what is it that people don't like about rats? And so Stephen Jay Gould has this fantastic essay that was written on the 50th anniversary of the creation of Mickey Mouse that's called A Biological Homage to Mickey Mouse. And he traces the way the illustrators changed the way Mickey Mouse looked over the years. And originally, he kind of looked like a rat. He was pointier. He was also kind of a jerk as a character. He did nasty, nasty things. So as they made him nicer, they also made him rounder. And Gould quotes the kind of the founder of modern ethology or the study of animal behavior, Conrad Lorenz, who talks about the fact that we humans prefer creatures who look like baby humans with round faces, with big eyes. They're kind of blobby because it triggers a mechanism in us that makes us want to protect them. That's why panda bears are unbearably cute. You know, they're round and they have those big, it looks like they have big eyes. And that's what happens with domestication. So there have been studies of domesticated animals. There was a study in Siberia of foxes, and they took a group of foxes and domesticated them. And as they became more used to humans and domesticated, their body changed. Their ears got floppier. Their snouts got shorter. They developed patches of white on their coats because wild animals, you know, tend not to be white. They tend to blend in with their environment. But when you see domesticated animals, you see lots of white. And so all these morphological changes came about with domestication. And so rats look wild, even though they've been domesticated far longer than, you know, the adorable round hamsters that, you know, when you look at them, you can't help but go, oh, because they're so cute. They're round. They're vicious. Hamsters bite, and they're not social. So they make terrible pets. I'm sorry if anybody has a hamster, and there are some great hamsters. But in general, hamsters, because they haven't been domesticated as long as rats have, they're not good pets. Rats have been domesticated for a long time, and that's why you have white rats and you have all these different colors, but they're still pointy. So they have, you know, pointy ears, pointy noses, pointy tails. On the cover of my book, there's a great photo from a Dutch photographer of a rat, and he's cuddly looking, and he's a Dumbo rat. There's a recessive gene that causes them to have rounder faces. Their ears are set farther back, and they're kind of like the gateway drugs for people who don't like rats, because once you see one of the Dumbo rats and you get to know that rat and you get to hold it, then you're like, oh, maybe they're okay. So yeah, it was interesting to learn about what domestication did to the bodies of the animals we choose to live with.
Something I learned from reading the book is that there's something called, is it National Rat Day? Or
yeah, there is. World Rat Day.
World Rat Day.
Yes. You know what? And that's the thing about loving rats is that you never know who the rat lovers in a room are. Because, like, you know, most of us, including me, don't go to events on World Rat Day. But whenever I'm in a group of people and, you know, I'm asked, like, you know, what were you working on for the last 10 years, or, you know, what's your book about? I would say, well, I'm working on a book about rats. And in every gathering, there's going to be someone who says, oh, I love rats. And, you know, often it's mothers who took care of their kids' rats, you know, because the kids wanted a pet and they would get the rats. Sometimes it's people who've worked in small animal hospitals, because rats are so much easier to treat because they never get angry. They let people do amazing things to them. Often it's people who worked in labs, you know, people who did psychology experiments in college. So you just, it's kind of the secret society that you just don't know who the rat lovers are. But then there are those who wear their love for their rats proudly and show up on World Rat Day and bring I went to a rat show. There are rat shows and there are contests, and they either have them do things or it's for breeding. It's like, you know, any other niche culture, the way the horse people are, you know, they talk about, you know, horses that are typey. Well, there are rats that are typey. So it's a whole other world that I learned about through the book.
I love the idea that there's an actual event called Ratapalooza.
Yes, and I went to Ratapalooza with some friends in Seattle, and they wanted to adopt. They had babysat for Iris when they lived in Spokane. They moved to Seattle, and they wanted to adopt some baby rats, and we got to Ratapalooza, and there were no babies to be adopted. But we did see lots of really interesting different kinds of rats, and hairless rats that kind of look a little bit like E.T., and then tiny little dwarf rats and all sorts of different. You'd be surprised at how many different kinds of rats there are.
If somebody decides to get a pet rat, you have some advice about where they should be looking for a rat.
Yeah, and in a chapter in the book called Mistakes Were Made, I cop to all the things that I didn't know when I went to get Iris. And I mean, basically, you know, I got Iris from a pet store at the mall in Missoula. And I was fortunate, because often rats who are in pet stores the females come home pregnant. So you go to get one rat and you end up with 13. So if they don't separate the males and the females really early on, one of the things about rats that's most amazing is their fecundity. So one of the statistics that Robert Sullivan mentions in his book is that one pair of rats can produce 15,000 descendants in a year. So they're prodigious breeders. And, you know, if you don't want to start your own rat farm, you probably don't want to get a rat from the pet store who might be pregnant. They also come home sick. So there are a bunch of different kinds of diseases that rats are susceptible to. And so what I learned, even though I got Iris from a pet store and she was healthy her whole life, was that there are people who breed rats. And there are things called ratteries. And I wanted to go visit a rattery. And then I learned that mostly what they are is like a room in somebody's home where they just have a bunch of cages of rats. And these people become kind of amateur geneticists. And so they realize they have a great rat and she has a great temperament. And so they use her. You know, you can do genetic experiments pretty quickly because their generations turn over so quickly. And so there are lists of rat breeders on the web all over the place. And, you know, sometimes it's kids. Sometimes it's people who've been doing it for 20 or 30 years. It's a diverse group that's hard to characterize.
But they're breeding rats in some cases, just like puppy mills. So they have diseases and they're not well socialized and all of those things.
The breeders tend to keep very careful track of the lineage and they keep careful notes. They really, I mean, they take it very, very seriously. And yeah, so the commercial labs are like puppy mills. And so you get all the same kind of problems you get when you go to get a dog from a puppy mill. And they also, they handle the rats when they're young. And that's really important too, because I've only had two rats in my life, but my first rat I had right after college, and she'd grown up in Brookhaven National Labs. And so she was a lab rat from way back. And it took a while for us to get used to each other. But most rats tend to be nice. And once you start handling them, they, you know, come around and are very affectionate. But it's even better to get one that's been handled a lot as a baby.
You made a list of Iris's attributes, your fancy rat, Iris, which I'd like you to read.
Yeah, I often thought I should have a bracelet that said, "What would Iris do?" Because she was a role model for me. So Iris was fastidiously clean, except for occasional tail hygiene issues, always in a good mood, welcoming to strangers, eager to explore, considerate of friends, willing to share, empathetic, industrious, athletic, fearless, funny, gorgeous, a good sleeper, a thoughtful eater, not a biter, able to endure pain without complaint, tender to dogs, benevolent to children.
Rachel Tour lives in Spokane, Washington. Look for more information about her and her mini books at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, poems and children's book reviews, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. And just to be sure you don't miss any of these conversations, sign up for our podcast at mtpr.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.